G'day everybody, I'm Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
Welcome to the Tactical Tennis Podcast. We're going to spend time tonight talking about the quarterfinals of the US Open that nobody predicted.
We predicted this entire draw. What are you talking about?
Yeah, right. No, we got
a flawless draw challenge.
We got half of the quarterfinal picks wrong. Well,
two and a half at most. Yeah.
Yeah. Two right, and then one and a half ish wrong. I'm for me two wrong, because I'll flat out say that I did think Federer was going to pull through on Del Potro, and I think you were a little bit up in the air on that one.
But I was really worried about that one, yeah.
Yeah, I won't say that I wasn't worried, but I just felt like he was going to... I mean, I still feel like he should have done it. But let's talk about that when we get to it. Because we'll follow the pattern last time. We're starting with Corinna Busta and Schwartzman. Because one, we got it right. And two...
That's a nice place to start for
right,
once.
And then this is the beauty of it. We get to finish kind of... Well, if we go up the draw, we finish how we started. Though I think we'll save Fed and Delpo for last. But anyway, no... This is also the pattern that we followed last time we talked about the draw. So, Corinna Busta just manhandled Schwartzman, straight sets, 6-4, 6-4, 6-2. And...
Now,
yes.
To be fair, it was competitive.
No, absolutely.
The score was a manhandling.
Well, and even that, you know, I mean, like, this is one thing that bothers me when I hear people talk about tennis matches, and even if you look at a lot of the articles that get written out there, somebody will win like 7-5, 6-4, and the article headline will be so-and-so dominates so-and-so.
Absolutely.
And I'm always thinking, like, that's like a 2 or 3 point match right there. That's nothing.
Right.
Obviously it was competitive, but there's also a part where the match wasn't really in doubt.
He won all the really big points. He showed up for all the really big moments.
Yeah, The trends were there. You know, this is one of these matches. You know, I've talked a bit in the last few podcasts about making, like, definitive predictions on match outcomes is, I think, often a very foolish thing, because so often there are so many factors that go into play. Some matchups, though, you can predict pretty reliably, and this to me is one of those where you've got two guys in a lot of ways play somewhat similar games, and one of them is just a bit bigger and stronger, and, you know, I think most of the time he's going to win this matchup.
Yeah.
Especially in best of five. I just think that's the way that it's going to play out most of the time.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened, you know. If you look at the stats, he was comfortably in control of this match. I mean, the thing to me is, like, 97 points total, 1 to 72. That's a pretty hefty margin.
That's a big. That's in my book. That's actually a drumming.
Yeah, that is pretty much a drumming. Like I said, the outcome of this match was really never in doubt. And the big thing that it came down to was the second serves at the end of the day. You know, and I will say, like, you weren't wrong. Schwartzman is one heck of a returner. Like, oh my goodness, that guy hits a great return. But it just didn't really matter all that much. The irony is, like, Corinna Busta's basically winning points on his first and second serve at the same rate, which I think is really telling on the quality of Schwartzman's return. But then the second part of that is the fact that Corinna Busta just had a little more off the ground and, I guess, slightly better patterns, a little more reliable there, with a little more firepower as a whole, is also, you know, once Corinna Busta's winning those rallies, once Schwartzman gets them started. And, yeah, where we flip that, Schwartzman won 9 of 27. That's 33% of his second serve points. I mean, that's an abysmal number. And you cannot win matches at the Pro Tour winning 33% second serves unless you're making, you know, 90-something percent first serves. Life's going to be a little bit too tough there. But this wasn't to be a particularly interesting match. Like I said, it was a fairly predictable outcome, and nothing surprising happened. And so, you know, I'm sure Schwartzman probably comes away from that and feels like he didn't play particularly well. And maybe he's frustrated with the outcome. And this might be the kind of match where he's looking at that and saying, well, 6-4, 6-4, there's two sets I was really in. And, you know, but when I look at that match, I just think that's not really the case.
Right. He came up a step short over and over and over again.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that he should look at that and think, okay, if I can improve you know, just a couple of things.
Right. This is not a, I can go out there, if I go out there and play a little better, I win kind of situation.
Yeah, if he goes this and plays against Makar, right. he's still going to lose.
Yeah, exactly. He needs to come out with a, you know, an improved game plan and just be a little bit better somewhere. You know, he has to find something that he can do better than Karina Busta, other than the return of serve, or in addition to the return of serve, because he's returning better, but then he can't follow it up. You know, once right. Busta gets that rally back to neutral or stays ahead, and it's not going to go Schwartzman's way more often than not. I mean, it's not like Karina Busta's winning every point, people. Don't mistake us there. It's just that the odds are in his favor, and he's going to win more points than he loses against Schwartzman consistently.
So, I mean, honestly, he's way too many. Like, he was over 20 points ahead where, like, I mean, gosh, I was watching the double semifinal earlier, and the winning team was 6 points below. So, right. I mean, you're
and
just...
that doesn't happen very often. But,
no, it doesn't. But, like, six, I mean, 20 points, I mean, that's almost like a whole set worth of points that you're ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, usually we're used to these matches being decided by plus or minus 10 points.
Yeah, exactly.
So
yeah.
That's a big margin.
It is indeed. So if we move up to the next match in the draw, this was interesting. Anderson Query, we both felt like Query was going to come through on this one, and we were both wrong.
Well, Query certainly had the matchup.
Well,
and
I think
he's been the hot player on tour.
He's been the hot player on tour. I'm not so sure the matchup really was that. I felt like he was going to win because he was the hot player on tour. There's an element to where I'm not sure the matchup really is that great. They are in a lot of ways very similar players, except I feel like Query's got a little more firepower off the forehand, but Anderson's okay. Query has more firepower off the forehand. I won't understate that.
And the serve,
but Anderson has a more well-rounded game.
Yes. I think Anderson moves better for sure, and he's got a much more solid backhand, generally speaking, and a more solid return, generally
speaking. Yeah, and I just don't think the serve is really... I don't think that the gap on the serve is as big.
It's big. Anderson just doesn't have the variety. He doesn't have the spin. He doesn't have the action.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, here's
he's closing the gap, but I think
yeah,
it's still.
Yeah, well, I mean, he certainly hit more aces than Query did. He fired down 22 aces in four sets, with only three double faults. Right, but the big thing to me is, look, I mean, they are very similar players. I mean, yes, there are differences. Anderson's a little more well-rounded. Query brings a little more firepower to the table, but this is really the thing that it came down to. Was this was a match that was entirely effectively decided by first serve percentage, funnily enough. Because when you go through and you look at the way this match played out, like, Anderson came forward a little more, but they had similar win rates than that, and Query came forward some. They were very even in almost every regard, except for Anderson's making 67% first serves, and Query's making 55% first serves. And that's the match.
Now, to me, I say Sam's got more firepower on the serve. But for Kevin to serve over 20 aces and serve at near 70%, I mean, that's as good as he can play.
That's pretty
fantastic. That's got to be as good a numbers as he's ever put up. So he basically, it seemed, went out there and was as aggressive as he could be. And... you know, didn't make very many errors. Like, he reminds me of
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't say that he was as aggressive as he could be. I would just say he had a very good serving day. Let's maybe frame it in those terms, because, you know, I didn't see him trying to hit serves that he wouldn't normally try to hit. I didn't see him really feel like he was pushing the edge on the serve. I think he just served really well. And I'm just pulling up super quick some of his numbers from other matches that he played at the tournament. I mean, he served 65% first serves against Lorenzi, for example. I mean, that's a pretty good number.
How many aces did he hit in that one?
That's a good question. He hit 18 aces in four sets. So I don't think this was a situation where he went absolutely crazy. He served well the whole tournament, by and large. 65% yes. against Coric. Again, 12 aces, but that was three very kind of blowout sets. You know, if we look at his match against Gulbis, he rocked 63% first serves there with 18 aces, also in three sets. I mean, he had a slightly better serving day than he had been having, but certainly it was on par with the rest of the tournament.
Well, he's been playing really well. I mean, this is the best that we've maybe seen him play ever, but it's certainly the best we've seen him play since he was top 10 and looked like he was going to be a stalwart.
Right, and then, you know, the injuries happened, and I think he seems to genuinely be back now. But so coming back to this specific match, they both won, basically. I mean, he won 81% or 82% second serves. Query won 81%. Sorry, on their first serves, and their win rate on their second serves was comparable at 60 and 55. The big difference is, and this is really what it comes down to, is that by making so many first serves, Query had to hit 69 second serves in that match to Anderson's 48.
Yeah.
You know, and then when you look at the gap between the win percentage on first second serves, I mean, that's the match right there. That's the gap. I mean, he ends up with an extra 14 points over the course of the match, which is, you know, that's a solid margin. You know, he hits more winners, has a few more unforced errors. I think he was driving play more. But look, when you're making more first serves, people, you get to drive play more because you're starting more points ahead. And
that frees him up to be more aggressive on their terms.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, Sam didn't serve great, to be honest with you. I mean, he had 7 double faults. That's not that's not a good number for a 6'5", 6'6", guy.
6'6", for sure, 6'7". I mean, they're basically, they seem that they're about the same size. I think Kevin's a little bit taller. I mean, Kevin might be closer to 6'8 than 6'7".
No,
it's a little hard to tell.
Anderson's, by the numbers at least, Query 6'6 and Anderson's 6'8, but they are self-reported, so who knows? Look, folks, they don't show up to the tournament and get out a measuring tape.
They basically don't change those numbers from the time that they come on tour. I mean,
right. And the other
Sam
part of
Curry
it is,
still got, I think, the picture on his U.S. Open ID from when he was like 19.
Right. And the other part of this too is a lot of these guys, when you'll see that, you know, I mean, if you live in countries other than the U.S., almost everybody else is using meters and centimeters, and so then when they report their height in centimeters, for example, it gets rounded as well, you know, to put it into inches. So sometimes it gets rounded up, sometimes it gets rounded down, and sometimes the players report numbers that are a little bit generous. So, you know, the height thing
like
is...
Like Schwartzman being 5'7".
Take it with a grain of salt, but either way, these guys are very, very large in height, and they both, you know, should be putting pretty high numbers up on the serve in terms of the percentages. And Query didn't serve his best, and at the end of the day, I mean, Anderson's first serve percentage was really the difference maker in this match. So
do you expect Anderson to be able to continue serving at this level moving forward?
I do. I mean, barring another injury, I see no reason. I mean, look, he's always going to be in the mid-60s, I think. There's no doubt to me about that, unless something goes wrong with him physically. You know, I think on good days he'll be high 60s. On bad days he'll be mid to low 60s, like 63, 64. But, you know, he's got a pretty simple, clean motion. There's not like a huge amount of variation from day to day. I just think he's back. He's fully healthy now, and he's able to come out and really bring his best. And I think he's going to do well against Karina Busta.
Look, I mean, if he serves 20 something aces and serves at, you know, 67%,
right?
He's just going to be tough to ever get a break.
Right. Absolutely. But we'll get to the semifinals predictions in a minute. I think let's talk about Nadal Rublev, because In a way, this was a very interesting match, in a way, very not interesting. I'm sure people watching it, for the most part, probably felt like this was very disappointing. But there's a way in which, to me, this is the kind of match that people listening can learn a lot from.
Now, how's that?
Well, because, look, if you look at Del Potro Federer, you know, as an example, which we'll talk about briefly, or even actually just the Anderson Query match, you know, what's your takeaway there is go practice your serve. Because, you know, if the difference maker is just that somebody served better than the other guy on the day, then, you know, that's a slim margin. And I don't think there's a lot you learn from that, because I think they both came out and basically played the way they should. But this match, however, totally different story. Because, look, Rublev has the firepower to be dangerous to Nadal. He absolutely does. And he came out and served quite well in terms of his first serve. His second serve, not so great. But his first serve was, you know, I mean, he served at 62%. That's a pretty good number for a guy who comes out and is aggressive when he serves the way that he is.
Yeah.
But he's losing every ground stroke rally. And he's not losing the ground stroke rally because he doesn't have enough juice to compete with Nadal. He's losing almost every ground stroke rally, or so many of them, because he's playing with so little structure. This was, you know, if I look at the Federer match, Federer lost that on like small scale tactical decisions that may or may not have been, you know, partly influenced by, you know, his situation with his back. But this, Rublev lost this match on tactics 101.
Yeah.
You know, like, this was the introduction to tactics course that Rublev apparently didn't take in tennis college, because, you know, tactics 101 is when you're hitting your best shot to your opponent's weakest shot, stay on it until you get what you want. And what you want might be an error, or it might be a short ball that you can be aggressive on and come to the net behind, but you stay on it till you get what you want. And Rublev did none of that. He was getting his forehand, and he's hitting a forehand, and he hit a forehand into Nadal's backhand, gets the cross-court ball, and then his next forehand, does he take it back to the backhand, which is, you know, the weaker side for Nadal by a comfortable margin? No. He would slap balls like either straight up the middle or go down the line into Nadal's forehand and effectively gift-wrap control of the point to Nadal. And, of course, Nadal's not making that rookie error. So the moment he hands control of the point to Nadal, Nadal takes that control and, like, beats him over the head with it. And that's what we just saw. And so you end up with this match where Rublev's changing direction of the ball for no good reason, which, of course, is going to massively up his unforced error count. And we see that. I mean, the kid hit 43 unforced errors in three sets. But that's not coincidence. This isn't Rublev having a bad day. This is Rublev putting himself in a bad situation, trying to hit the wrong shot against the wrong guy.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's pretty interesting because I suppose I should come out and tell people that I've actually coached against Rublev. And, you know, watching him, I just thought, all right, he hits a clean ball. He's got virtually no game plan. Like, he's trying to hit through you. And he's still a teenager. He was the last teenager standing in the tournament. Kudos to him. Hats off for winning. I don't know how many matches he won. He won a lot of matches. But, you know, when you look at him up against Nadal, I mean, he was beside himself. Like, I can't believe that I can't just, you know, hit one over to the forehand side, hit one over to the backhand side, and then hit one over to the forehand side again, and I didn't win the point. Like, what's going on?
Right, because there's a lot of where he got away with that in early matches.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking to myself, like, you're in the quarterfinals of the U.S. Open. Like, it's not junior tennis anymore. I mean, surely your expectations have changed. I mean, did you, like, it seemed to me like he actually came into that match thinking, I'm just going to hit through Nadal. And
right.
I honestly think that he thought he was going to go out there and straight set Nadal, maybe drop a set, but that he was just, that he just had.
Was hitting the ball that well, yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing, because when you look at his matches leading into this, into the quarterfinals, so, you know, he has strung together. He's strung together good wins. I mean, he beat Badene in straights his first match, takes down Dimitrov in straight sets, Zuma in four, and then Goffin in straight. So there's a part where, you know, he probably feels like that wasn't crazy to expect.
I mean, look, those are great wins.
They are, but you got to ask, like,
but
why?
But hitting through Goffin and hitting through Nadal.
Yeah, very different stories. And the second part of it is, like, look, if you're playing and you've got a hot hand and you're swinging away and everything's dropping in, that's great, but that's not going to last forever. And when it stops, you have to have a plan B.
Well, he doesn't have a plan B.
No, I'm just, not like, even sure he has a plan A.
His plan is, I'm just going to out-hit you. And yeah. This is the thing, like, what I will say, one thing that I'll say that I think is really, one, it's really cool, and two, it's really important for us to understand when we look at tennis overall as a whole, is that the next gen, to borrow the ATP terminology, like this next generation of younger guys that's coming up, they really do hit the ball better than the top 40 guys right now. Now, do they hit the ball better than Rafa and Roger and Stan? No. Okay, no, they don't. Because those guys are hitting the ball awfully, awfully good. But, like, Rublev was at the bottom of this kind of group of teenagers that we thought had a shot to do well. And I don't even think he hits the ball better than all those other guys. Like, I really don't. I think that he had good matchups and that, like you said, he had kind of a hot hand for the tournament. I think there's a lot of guys that he could have played in the first round where he would have lost and been out. especially with the tactics that he uses.
Right.
But there's really a lack of tactics in Rublev's game. I mean, he's very, very predictable. And if you're going to do your homework against him, then he has a hard time. I mean, at this stage. Now, sure. He's still very young.
Yes.
I mean,
he's got
lots of time to learn tactics. It's just a little disheartening that here he is in the quarterfinals of the U.S. Open, and it seems like he's not dedicating any of his training time to that. That instead, he literally seems to dedicate all his training time to hitting the ball well.
Right. Yeah, there was a little bit where the mismatch was so stark and strong. There's a little bit where this was amateur hour when it comes to his approach to this match.
Yeah,
and you just can't do that. I mean, you're playing Rafael Nadal.
And I think since it was Rafa, it's easy to be like, oh, wow, well, you lost to Rafa. Like, he's one of the greatest players of all time. But look, if he had played Schwartzman, I think Schwartzman would have picked him apart. If he had played Carreño Busta, I think Carreño Busta would have picked him apart.
Agreed.
Like, if he had played Kevin Anderson,
different. Yeah.
I don't think he's going to hit through Kevin Anderson. I don't think he would have hit through Sam Querrey.
Right.
Like, yeah, it's Rafa, so it's easy to say, oh, okay, I lost to Rafa, and I did course. You know, I don't know that I'm going to look at Rublev as a guy that's going to win, you know, three rounds or two rounds at the Open next year.
Right.
I don't know that I expect him to win two rounds in Melbourne.
Right. I mean, he just has to be, and we expect that he should, hopefully, continue to develop that aspect of his game. But the reality was, by a good margin, he was the weakest of the quarterfinalists. He had great wins, but you can't rely on hitting the ball well and that alone.
I think he had the element of surprise to sneak through Benenet in the beginning of the tournament.
Mm-hmm.
I really think, I mean, this is his coming out party on the ATP. He hasn't played a ton of ATP matches.
Right.
And I think he's in that honeymoon period where people haven't watched him. They haven't seen him. And look, the truth is probably in the first two rounds, guys are thinking, oh, I get a low ranked teenager, I'll be fine. They're probably not saying, oh, I'm going to go study film for 5 hours and make sure that I beat this guy.
Right.
And I think that was the mistake that people really ran into. And it's going to be really telling to see how he does in Melbourne. I mean, I don't rate him as high as, say, the Canadians, who, you know, are consistently beating good guys, and everybody knows how they play now.
Sure.
So that one I'm going to keep an eye on. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, so that brings us to the match from last night, which it was interesting. There's so many different ways I want to talk about this match, and there's a part where you know it's hard sometimes to separate out the bias. I mean, we all have our players that we you know, like.
Both love Federer. Come on.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and I'm a big Del Potro fan. Like, I think he's great. And, you know, I've always liked his game.
Yeah, you know, you've always been a huge Del Potro
fan. Yeah, I love his, like, the conviction with which he goes out and plays his game. And, you know, the forehand and the commitment to it. This to me was, and look, there's some unknowns about Fed's physical condition. I mean, he indicated after the match that things weren't right. He didn't look physically terrible out there, but there was weird decisions that he made at times that are hard not to attribute to, you know, how he may have been feeling.
Okay, let's frame this out. It's important, I think, the way that we really look at this. Okay,
sure.
So there are two things that I think really stand out. One, it seems like Fed actually has an issue with his back because it seems like it got to his head.
Yes.
All right. It seems like he was worried about it, and that's what's important. Now, is his back falling apart? No. If you watch the match, he played great tennis some of the time, right?
Yeah. A lot
but
of the time.
It's definitely
actually,
in his
yeah.
head. And you have to consider that. I mean, if he's out there, you know, 30 all, 5 all, and he's setting up to hit a serve, and he's thinking, man, if I do this the wrong way, my back's going to start to spasm on me, or I'm going to start cramping, or like I'm going to, you know, slip a disc or something. I mean, who knows what's in his head, right? But this is the normal stuff that players normally would think, right? If you have that thought going through your head, guess what? You're not going to be the Roger Federer that we are used to seeing. That's the way that things work. Like,
sure.
he did not win 19 Grand Slams stepping up to big points, worrying about his body holding up in the point.
No, that's absolutely true. Period. Yeah, and that's really the critical point here, because when we look at his actual play, like, by and large, he played quite well. He certainly, I think, did enough to have won the match, but there was just some critical moments where he made what I'll just call questionable decisions and unusual decisions for him that really changed the outcome. And look, that's not to take anything away from Del Potro. Like, let's be real.
Del Potro played very well. Came up with everything that he needed to come up with.
Yes, he absolutely did.
There were a couple of surprises. So I know one of the things that you're going to want to point out is when Fed hit a couple of serves right into the Del Potro wheelhouse of a backhand.
Yeah, not just that, but they came in behind them.
But they came into the middle of the court. And it,
and big points, like over and over again. Points.
You have to give Delpo credit, though. He hit his best backhands of the tournament, probably, on those shots.
Absolutely. And so, but there's that element where, I mean, Fed set him up to do it. So you had to
definitely set him up to do it. Yeah, there's plenty of times when Fed set up a lot of players to do that in the past. And guess what?
Right.
They look across the net, they see Roger Federer, and they crumble.
No, absolutely. Look, I think Del Potro played very well. You know, I think he did what he needed to do. He played a good, clean match. You know, when we look at that third set breaker, I mean, I think the match was there for the taking for Fed, and he came up short. And, yeah, when I look at the way he made decisions on those big points, it's unusual. You know, there's a couple of unusual things I saw from him last night that you don't normally see. You know, and I'd mentioned this to you earlier. There was a point earlier in the match, he ended up hitting a forehand winner on the shot, but where he was genuinely off balance. Like his feet were not right, and he had to make some corrective steps in a way that I've literally, in 14 years of watching him play matches, I've never seen him move like that before, ever.
And look, this is a really subtle thing, and it's important because I don't want people to get the wrong idea. But I mean, let's keep in mind, Glenn, you're looking at movement in a different way than, say, the casual fan is here, right? Like, this is a guy that I'm sitting here talking to right now that's got multiple black belts and moves very, very well himself. And so when you say that he moved funny on this forehand, this is really significant, right? Like, it's not something you're imagining. It's something that I saw as well, just to back that up. And, my thing is studying movement. And it's just an out of the blue, like, whoa, what's going on? Like, does Federer have the flu? Does he have a migraine? Like, is there something wrong with his balance in his brain? Like, what's with this all this sudden weird sort of step to the ball stuff that we'd never seen before, okay? So he does this. He still recovers, hits a good shot. We've kind of come to expect that from Federer. But there were other moments during the match as well that felt, I think, to both of us like something weird's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, like one of the set points in the breaker where he did serve and volley, played that short low ball, and then instead of closing and putting that volley away, he steps back when Delpo kind of just bunts it over. He steps back and kind of hits this off-balance half volley, topspin backhand thing that just wasn't at all the kind of decision that I'm used to seeing from him. It just was an odd. There's just these moments like that. It's like the wide serves that he hit in the breaker when he had the set points, and then on the break point early in the fourth set, where we're not used to when Fed hits that wide serve, he hits his spot. He either misses it or he hits his spot. When I say he misses, I mean he misses it wide or he hits his spot.
He doesn't usually miss it into your wheelhouse.
He doesn't put it in people's wheelhouse, and he also doesn't put it in people's wheelhouse at like a buck five, 105 miles an hour.
He misses it like 10 or 15 miles an hour,
slower. So he normally, like, he'll either miss it wide at 120 to 125, or he'll hit his spot at 120, 125. He won't slot it into your backhand at 105. And he did that more than once, and that's not a normal thing for him. This to me was not a match. I mean, we said before this match, this was going to be a match that came down to who got to hit the most forehands. And I think that, by and large, held true. I mean, the forehand was the shot that decided the match overall. and for both players. And I think that in that regard, they both actually hit their forehands quite well. And you know, it just at the end of the day came down to this small handful of points late, you know, at the end of the third set and then early in the fourth, and that was it.
You know, one of the things that really stood out to me is Delpo looked exhausted. Okay, he's been battling a cold, which is genuine, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's hit a ball in between matches for the last couple of rounds, from what I could tell from being over there. Certainly haven't seen him out on the practice court. Now, I could be wrong about that, but the impression is that that's how it's been. And the truth is, if he has hit a ball, he's definitely not. I mean, he's not like Rafa where he's going out there and working hard in between matches. I mean, I really think that he was absolutely gassed in that match, and he's getting through it on adrenaline.
Well, I mean, the crowd didn't hurt him, that's for sure.
No, I mean, the crowd helped him. I mean, New York loves an underdog. Delpo's won there before. He was under the weather, and everyone's thinking that, you know, Fed's having this great year, and he's on a roll, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I think that's something. I think that this actually worked to his advantage a little bit, because Delpo is basically in a state where it's easier for him to reach a flow state of performance.
Right.
Like he's working sort of above 90% effort. Like he's laying it on the line, and he's actually too tired to feel anxiety. He's too tired to get tight. And he's really too tired to do anything except for just let it rip. And when Delpo lets it rip is when he's at his absolute best. And so we saw that when Federer's serve came into the slot in the backhand, all of a sudden, late into that match, it was like, oh, he wrecked a backhand. Where'd that come from?
Right,
because
his backhand had looked odd at
pretty
times.
Average.
Like, I mean, some of his movement on that backhand side had been a little odd. He hit a lot of them in kind of a weird semi-open stance with like yep. almost in a partial squat.
Which is something you do when you're tired.
Yeah, no, for sure. But, I remember there was a point during that third set, I want to say it was, where Fed had gone to the backhand with his forehand and gotten back a very weak response. And then the very next point, Fed went to the forehand instead and got just wrecked. And the commentator said something about it and said, well, why would you go to the forehand there? Why didn't he go back at the backhand that had just looked so weak and out of sorts? But that came and went throughout the match. There was just little stretches where Delpo's backhand looked very ordinary, and then he'd hit it great. But then, again, like several rallies in a row where it just looked very vulnerable. But I didn't feel like Fed really took advantage of it the way that he should have.
So there's always emotional and psychological battles that happen in these matches. And this is what really jumped out to me. Is that Federer seemed out of sorts, not just with some of his decision-making, but emotionally, he was in a place that we've very rarely seen him. And it seemed to me that whether it was his back or whether it was something else that we've got no idea. I mean, we don't know everything about what's going on in this guy's life.
Right. I mean, he's indicating the back, but... Yeah.
It's easy to forget that. And we've got no idea what this injury is. Like... We say back because he said back, but I mean, goodness, like he might just be saying back because if we say, oh, your lower back's bothering you and it's not that big of a deal and it's better the next week, it's something we can all relate to. But like, who knows what it is? Maybe he's got something that, you know, he just doesn't want to make public. I mean,
sure.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. So the important thing is that he lost the emotional and psychological battle here. Whatever was bothering him, it was getting to him.
Yeah.
So after he drops that tiebreaker, he's rushing at the beginning of the next set, not just rushing through the changeover. Like I can see if his back was stiffening up on him, maybe he didn't want to sit down, didn't want to rest too much. Like you and I definitely know what that's like.
Right.
Like, you know, it's better to keep moving. That's a good strategy. But he wasn't just let's keep moving.
Right.
He's rushing in between points. He's rushing up to the service line. He's rushing, I think, his service motion a little bit. And, I mean, this is, like, just not something we see from him. Like, I think of Federer like I think of Pete Sampras. Here's a guy who would take his time, slow down, bounce the ball three times, pick a spot. I mean, he's very deliberate. He's not a slow player like Rafa.
No.
But he's not emotionally teetering.
Right. He's difficult to rattle. And that's, you know, that was an interesting point, because then this is where I think, like, full kudos go to Del Potro, because Del Potro obviously wasn't feeling great the last couple of rounds. He looked obviously a lot better last night. Stretches where he looked tired, and like we were mentioning on the back end, the footwork got odd and sloppy. But he embraced all of that, and he came out, and he really fought hard. Fed looked almost a little bit like, I mean, he wanted to win, but there was a part of him that was, like, scared to win.
Yeah, I really think there was. There was something weird going on. Where this is my, and it's interesting, like, if you think back about how I talked about this match beforehand, I didn't say anything about the actual technical matchup of Delpo's game and Federer's game. This had that feeling of, it's just, like, is Federer going to feel something, I don't want to call it pressure, it's something else, but it's a very weird situation. Like, we've never seen a player who has an opportunity to maybe get his 20th Grand Slam to beat a former U.S. Open champion in Delpo and then to then have Rafa in the semis. I mean, if Federer was able to get through that match, he's been beating Rafa this year. He'd be a huge favorite if he made his way to the final against whoever was in the bottom half. Like, it really felt to me like he was thinking ahead, that he was thinking ahead to Rafa. That he was thinking ahead to the final.
I don't think he made it as far as the final. I think he's in his head. He's out there thinking, "I can't beat Rafa," feeling like this.
Yeah, and that could be too, because he might be thinking, "I don't like better for him to lose to Del Potro than to lose to Rafa," which is a weird thing. But that's part of why he didn't play the French Open. I don't think that Federer would come out and say that. But if I was coaching him, I would tell him, look, come on, man. If you're not – like, if you don't understand this, then you're just lacking self-awareness. Right. And it's not a bad play. Like, it's a smart play.
Sure. I mean, there's still plenty of time left in the year for him to get number one if he gets healthy and he comes out and wins some tournaments.
He may see him in the Tour Finals, where Federer has owned the Tour Finals over his career, especially over Rafa. So imagine if he gets Rafa in the finals of the Tour Finals – beats him there and has that going into Melbourne, he might be able to beat him again.
Right.
So not a bad play on Federer's part, but really, really interesting dynamics at play. And I think that in a way, Del Potro kind of was lucky to be as fatigued as he was, because I think it put him in a better mental state.
Sure.
But at the same time, like, and I want to be really clear about this, there were so many guys at the very highest level that still get to that state and they fold.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, Delpo gets massive credit for being able to win that match in those circumstances.
Like I said, he embraced it. I mean, he was a warrior, you know?
I mean, so good. And as a side note, the last thing I want to say about this match is that I don't think Del Potro – I guess I should come out and say, like, I think Delpo will lose the next match, because I don't think his fitness level is good enough for him to keep winning matches that are this tough over and over and over again.
Right.
And so to do that against Fed at night in New York in this year, I mean, it's just, you really tip your cap. I mean, it's...
Sure, but also, I mean, you have to recognize that that's taken a lot out of him. And, I think, to me, Del Potro's backhand looked vulnerable. In stretches especially, but it definitely looked vulnerable at times. And this is the difference especially between Rafa on any day compared to Fed last night, is that Rafa's, you know, the moment that blood's in the water, I mean, that's it. He's going into a feeding frenzy. That's gonna be all she wrote. But let's talk quickly about the Anderson Corina Busta match first, and then we'll break down Nadal Del Potro before we call it a night. So Who do you see? Well, first, let's talk about how we see this match playing out. Not sort of the outcome, but the matchup itself. You know, what's a rally between these guys going to look like? What's Corina Busta going to do to hold serve?
I mean, work the ball around and go down the line at some point.
Right. So, I mean, this is an interesting matchup in that Anderson comes out and he brings the big serve to the table. He's going to hit hard, relatively hard and flatter and through the court. And he has to stay on the initiative. He moves well for a big guy, but he's not one of the Spaniard baseliners. Nobody will ever confuse him for one of the Spaniard baseliners. And right. Guess what Corina Busta is?
Yeah.
He's one of the Spaniard baseliners. And so there's an element to where if Corina Busta can keep the baseline rallies neutral and Anderson's not getting many free points on his serve, and I don't just mean the serve itself, but serve plus one, then Corina Busta's going to win this match. But if Anderson can keep his service points short, bang a first serve in and either hit an ace or something doesn't come back, or hit a big serve, get back a weak shot, hit a forehand, and maybe come forward and finish, and keep doing that on his own service games, he's going to hold serve well. And then it's going to come down to how good a job Corina Busta does of defending his own serve.
Well, look, Corina Busta is on track to finish in the top 10 this year. He's on track to finish in the top 8 this year.
Yeah, he's had a great year.
Or top 7. So,
I mean, he's had the easiest tournament so far. He still hasn't dropped a set. Through to the semis.
No, yeah, I mean, he's just rolling people. It's really,
by the way,
I mean,
one of 11 men in the Open era to make the semifinals of a slam without dropping a set.
Which is insane. I mean, that's
rare company.
Exceedingly rare air. So, to me, you look at Corina Busta, and nothing really jumps out like, wow, that guy's, like, he's not Sam Querrey with a serve or Sam Querrey with a forehand. He's not Rafa with the movement or Rafa with the forehand. He's not Federer, where he's just, like, beautiful to watch. But the thing that jumps out to me is it's very hard to win points serve plus one against this guy.
Yes.
Like, you're watching it and you're kind of not sure necessarily what he's done that's so great, but you find yourself in ground stroke points again and again and again and again. And he does well there. I mean, he's winning, I think, a little bit more than 50%. But basically, you know, rallies from the baseline are a losing proposition for all the guys on the tour.
Right.
So if you're finding yourself in rallies all the time on your serve, you're probably going to lose. Like, you need either some free points or at least you need consistently some serve plus 1 points. Even, like,
Anderson especially. I mean, Anderson in this matchup especially needs that.
Especially. And he's going to hit some aces.
Yeah.
My thing is, what's the serve plus one going to look like?
Right.
I don't think he can stop hitting the aces. But I think
he's
going to
hit probably like six aces a set, give or take. And that's, look, you can't. Six aces a set doesn't get you holding serve.
Right.
You know, that gets you one basically starting at 15 love every service game, let's say. But then you got to win the other 3 points somehow.
Yeah, and if you're starting at 15 love, then that's actually, I mean, you're going to hold something like 87% of the time, but you're still going to a breaker and getting broken every other set. You're probably losing the match at that rate.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just, Corina Busta doesn't have big weaknesses. He hits a good ball. He moves well. He's feeling confident out here. He's going to be fresh as a daisy. And I think he's coming in here as the underdog, despite having the higher ranking. He's like a sleeper in the locker room. Like, nobody's even talking about him. They're just kind of like, oh, look at that. Like,
right. Because, I mean, Anderson's a former top 10. Again. You know, Anderson's a former top 10 player. He's,
right.
You know, he's 6'8". He's got weapons. I mean, like, he's a little more well-known. And he's been around longer. He's been, you know, at the top of the game from several years ago. So,
and I think players are thinking of him like, oh, he's in top 10 form again.
Right. And Krenobus has kind of just quietly worked his way there. And he's a very workmanlike player. And he's got a, you know, he's done in a very workmanlike manner. I mean, he hasn't had, barring this semifinal result, like, he hasn't had any result this year that is mind-blowingly great. He hasn't come out and won a Masters event. He's just had consistent results throughout the year. And, yeah. And so, okay, that's how this match is going to play. Who's going to win it?
You know, I'm going to go against my emotions here.
Okay. Right?
So my gut tells me that Anderson's going to win it because of the way I saw him fist pumping, like, in the first points of the match early in this tournament. I mean, once he looked at the draw in the bottom half, I guarantee you KA was looking ahead going like, I'm getting back to the top 10, baby. Like, right. He was like, it's on. He's been working hard. He's more confident than he was 2 years ago. He's worked on shoring up some weaknesses. We can go into that some other time. But he feels like it's his time.
Fair enough.
But tactically, I think this is Karine Busta's match actually to lose. So if Karine Busta loses and if Kevin Anderson wins, I think it's going to be because he does not manage the moment, because it's his first Slam semifinal, because basically he's going to see the finish line and he's going to be thinking about getting to a final, and then he's just not going to play good tennis. And I don't really expect that to happen to Kevin Anderson as much.
Right. I'm going to go against you. I think Anderson's going to come away with this one. I think it's going to be in four, but I just think he's going to get the opportunity to play this match on his terms. And if he wasn't playing so well, then I think it would absolutely be Karine Busta's match to lose. But I think that the way that Anderson's playing and the way that he's serving, he's going to hold serve. He's going to do a good job of holding serve. He's going to hold serve all day long. I mean, I think he'll get broken probably once, and that'll be the set that he loses. But by and large, I think he's going to walk away with this one and make his first slam final.
I'm thinking from the tactical perspective here, it makes sense to say Karine Busta in five. And it almost pains me to say it because it feels weird. But when you're just looking and breaking it down, it's like, I mean, I tell you what, if Kevin Anderson wins this in four, I mean, he impressed the heck out of me just winning the last one. But I mean, it's going to be like, he's going to have to be in top 10 form to win this one.
Yeah, but I think he is.
He's going to have to be probably more than top 10 form, probably top 8 form.
Well,
so
we'll see. So if we move to the top half, then Nadal Del Potro, you know, this is where I think that, to me, I've got the opposite, where the head's going to have to override the heart on this one. And I think Nadal's going to walk away with this. The backhand for Del Potro was just shaky at times. Great at times, but shaky at times. Like I said, once Nadal smells that blood in the water, he's not letting go of that thing. And I, you know, Del Potro just has to play too well to win this match. He's serving about as well as I've ever seen him serve. And I was really impressed with his serving in the Fed match. And I think that's the only reason he actually has a real chance. And there's a lot of ways in which it's a nice matchup for him, because Nadal's ball sits up more, right, and Del Potro gets to hit downhill on that forehand. The problem to me is Nadal's going to make him hit too many high backhands that he can't really do much with.
Well, he used to love that.
I mean, he used to love it.
Before he had four wrist surgeries,
exactly.
three on his left and one on his right.
And that's,
he used to just routine those balls, and his backhand was automatic. I thought it was one of the best strokes on the tour. But it's, and I think they went over this in the match, it's like, it's so much slower. I mean, it's 14, 15 miles an hour slower than what it used to be.
Yeah.
Like, and he still doesn't have the confidence in that wrist. He's not hitting it the same way. And he's not going to hurt Rafa hitting 70 mile an hour backhands.
No, there's no way. That's not happening. And that to me is just going to be the big difference. When we talked about this idea from the Nadal-Rublev match of, look, I mean, you get the matchup that you want, like your forehand to his backhand, or your forehand to his forehand, or whatever it is, and then you stay on it until you get the ball that you want.
Yeah.
You know, Nadal's going to be able to do that. Del Potro doesn't have a reliable way to get off his own backhand onto his forehand into Nadal's backhand. He just doesn't, because once Nadal gets his forehand into Del Potro's backhand, you know, Del Potro can try and take it down the line, but he doesn't have enough juice on it. Nadal's going to run around that and punish him. And that's going to be the problem in this match. I think you're going to see Nadal's going to work hard. I think he's going to run further than Del Potro will. But he's going to hit a lot of forehands, and he's going to hit a lot of forehands from a position where he's in control of the point. The only way I think Del Potro comes away from this is if he, one, has a career serving day. If he comes out and serves unbelievably well, he can hold serve. The second part of this is, if he can use his slice backhand to change play and redirect play onto his own forehand, I think he has a shot. The problem is, he's going to have to do it early in rallies. You can't wait and wait and wait for an opportunity. You can't let Nadal hit 3, 4, 5 forehands into your backhand.
That's a tough ask, man.
No, I think if he takes like the first forehand that Nadal hits into his backhand, he slices that down the line, he's going to get punished some on that. Like, Nadal is going to take some of those backhands and rip them cross court and hurt him. But he will get to swing at some forehands, and that will shorten some rallies, and that'll keep his legs under him for longer out there, which I think he needs.
And it's a good play. I mean, to me, I've already made my prediction on this because I think that Del Potro is going to be out of gas. The only way that he wins this match is if he's so out of gas that he just swings free and just absolutely blasts through Rafa.
I think he's trying to do that either way. I don't think the gas is going to come into it at this point. But I think the point is I don't think he has enough gas. I think the only way that he does this is if he does have gas in the tank, and I don't think he has enough. And like I said, he just has to do too many things right. I don't think there's a scenario here where he could be so out of gas that, because he's, look, let's be real, where he is right now without the back end that he used to have, he's not walking out there and beating Nadal 2-2-2 like he did in 2009.
Yeah.
In the semifinal. No. That's not happening, right? That Del Potro is gone, folks. I hate to say it, but like until that back end gets fixed in some fashion, whether, you know, it is just a confidence issue, or, you know, he's got to kind of retrain the technique a little bit to where he's not going to come out and do that. And absent that, he has to work too hard for him to be able to go out there too tired to not swing freely and get across the finish line. It's not happening. And so I think the only way that this happens is if he tactically does exactly what he needs to do and plays unbelievably well.
Yeah, I mean, I just... You know, Del Potro doesn't spread the box on his serve. He pretty much serves through you. And I think Rafa's just going to be able to back up and outwork him.
Right. And that's the thing is, like, under different circumstances, he could, that would be fine. Like, he could serve and push. And actually, in a lot of ways, if you back up 8 years, that works really nicely for Del Potro, because when Rafa backs up, he tends to drop the ball a little short and it sits up, and then Del Potro hits downhill on it. The problem is going to be that he can only really do that well on one wing now.
And
he does it sometimes in the backhand, but it's just not on every... You can't... The problem is he can hit three great backhands, but three great backhands against Rafa doesn't win you the point. And then if you duff the force one a little bit, not even if you miss it, but you just kind of leave it hanging a little bit, then that's it. You've lost the point. And that's going to be the big problem.
I remember watching Del Potro play Rafa in Miami in like the semis or in the final, and this was years ago before the surgery. And I mean, he hit, no exaggeration, 40 like unbelievable backhands to come back in the third set and mount one of the biggest comebacks against Rafa that we've ever seen from any player. But I mean, he was hitting 40 or 50 of them. I mean, like, it was outrageous. It was like, wow, like, this guy may be a dominant number one. Because if he's going to go out and just hit, you know, 100, 150 unbelievable backhands, and that's not even counting his serves and his forehands, like, how are you going to beat him?
Right.
You know? But that's way too much to ask from him right now. I mean, if he does that, then it's a whole new Del Potro that we see, and it's going to be a remarkable turnaround, and it would be the story of the year to me. But either way, this is a match that I'm going to be planted in front of. I mean, I can't wait to watch this match.
Oh, there's going to be some very entertaining tennis there. There's no way around it. So that's it for us as far as breakdowns and predictions go. I guess we'll see if we're right or wrong. Hopefully do a little better than we did with our quarterfinal picks. I'm actually really disappointed. Normally I do really well with the match picks.
Speak for yourself there.
I've lost my streak, but oh well. Anyway, folks, if you have questions, comments, things that you would like to know about, please do shoot us an email. I'm Glenn, with one N, because I have to keep saying it for some reason, at tacticaltennis.com.
I'm Jacob at tacticaltennis.com. You got to stop saying it, because they're going to get to you either way.
Well, true enough. So anyways, folks, have a great day, and enjoy the semis, and we'll probably try to squeeze one out before the finals and talk about that match before it happens. So
make sure you watch some tennis, guys.
Yes, until then, later.